Our next speaker is Dr. Paul Eidelberg, known to most of you, who received his MA and PhD in political science from Chicago, taught at North Carolina State University, Kenyon College, University of Dallas, and is now with Claremont Men's College. He published The Philosophy of the American Constitution and a Discourse on Statesmanship. He's very hard at work on a book entitled On the Silence of the American Constitution, but also on a text entitled Beyond Détente. So he is the man who must have invented this particular session. So please redeem yourself.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bassoni. I have only one correction to make. The book that I'm supposedly working on. Yeah, it's a mistake. It's not your fault. I only correct a mistake, not whose mistake. It's on the silence of the Declaration of Independence rather than on the silence of the Constitution. I'm going to get right into the topic of beyond détente. I begin with a series of questions. Are there certain... Incidentally, can you all hear me? Can you all hear me? Good. Are there certain fundamental but unrecognized defects in the mentality of American statesmen? Clemenceau, referring to the problem of securing peace between democratic France and a Germany, nurturing even before Hitler a blatant doctrine of universal supremacy, in vain warned his countrymen that for a lasting peace it is necessary for both countries to have the same fundamental ideas of right and the same quality of good faith. In other words, the same basic principles of justice and of honor. Our American states are the architects of détente, governed consistently by this simple truth. Do they understand with any profundity the basic principles, the roots of Soviet foreign policy? Do they understand with any profundity the roots of American foreign policy, or I should say what once were the roots of American foreign policy, or what this country once stood for? Hence, against a tyranny like the Soviet Union, do they really know how to conduct the foreign policy of a republic? How to reconcile wisdom and consent? How to employ power on behalf of liberty, but in consonance with reason and civility? If not, this country's future, its security, is indeed precarious. Dr. Kissinger once said that national security is not primarily a technical problem, but a challenge to political understanding and ultimately to philosophical insight. Do American statesmen possess philosophical insight? The statesman's need for philosophic insight is made urgent by the inability of contemporary modes of thought to enlighten the American people, to restore that sense of unity and confidence necessary to halt the decline of the United States and the global ascendancy of the Soviet Union. A naive moralism, as well as a naive realism or pragmatism, have enfeebled American foreign policy. Moralists and pragmatists equally misconceive the nature of morality, despite their disagreement over what ought to be the role of moral considerations in international affairs. Both commit the common error of reducing morality to moral precepts or principles in contradistinction to moral judgment or prudence. There are many moral principles and these cannot but come into obstruction with one another. Moral judgment or prudence involves the mutual adjustment of moral principles or the coordination of competing values so as to maximize goodness or to minimize evil. Moralists and pragmatists thus obscure not only the complexity, but the architectonic character and potential grandeur of politics. Whereas moralists subordinate politics to inflexible dogmas, pragmatists subordinate politics to uninspiring interests. Closer examination of these dogmas and interests reveals, however, that moralism and pragmatism are not antithetical in the most decisive respect. For the primacy of altruism in the mentality of most moralists cooperates with the primacy of safety and material well-being in the mentality of pragmatists to produce a foreign policy whose highest aim is a peace reduced in significance to the mere avoidance of conflict. In other words, animating most moralists and pragmatists is a politics of survival, a politics which Professor Kissinger once deemed ultimately destructive of purpose and values. Moralism and pragmatism are thus less than they seem. On the surface, one appears sentimental, the other coldly calculating. Probing deeper, one discovers that pragmatists, like moralists, are sentimental enough to regard war as the greatest evil, a sentiment which renders moralists, like pragmatists, calculating enough to tolerate the subjugation of other nations rather than disturb the tranquility and material well-being of our own. And yet, in the once considered opinion of Professor Kissinger, whenever peace, conceived as the avoidance of war, has been the primary objective of nations or a group of nations, the world has been at the mercy of the most ruthless member of the international system. Whenever nations have acknowledged that certain principles could not be compromised, even for the sake of peace, stability, he said, based on equilibrium of forces, was at least conceivable. Now this suggests that whereas moralism lacks certain dimensions of morality, pragmatism lacks certain dimensions of reason. Moralism fails to reach the level of the noble or magnanimity. Pragmatism fails to reach the level of wisdom or philosophy. Neither is therefore capable of inspiring the American people or of achieving genuine peace, a peace which knows not merely the word, but the substance of honor. If American foreign policy has at times been distracted by moralism, the European Security Conference of 1975, also called, well, we'll call it the Spirit of Helsinki, suggests the actual as opposed to the verbal primacy of pragmatism. What pragmatism fails to offer is a prudent policy informed by a dynamic universality of principle or purpose. Needed is a policy capable of promoting the spirit of republicanism in the world while avoiding armed conflict with the Soviet Union. Putting aside that wishful thinking which only furthers the aims of the Kremlin, there is no reason to doubt that Russia will persist in its efforts to export communism, as it is doing in Africa, while avoiding armed conflict with the United States. That is, so long as we are not deterred on the strategic nuclear level. The task, therefore, is not merely to combine sentimental moralism and calculating pragmatism, but rather to transcend both in a synthesis issuing in a tough-minded politics of magnanimity. Taking prudence, which is presently understood as expediency, and infusing it with principle and manliness, the statesman will be able to harness the intellectual, moral, and material resources of the American people in such a way as to advance the cause of liberty and civility without threatening the vital interests of the Soviet Union. At the same time, he will demonstrate to the Kremlin that we shall forcefully resist any efforts on its part to undermine the vital interests of the United States. Not selective détente orchestrated by Moscow, but selective détente orchestrated by Washington. That should be one description of American foreign policy. Another, necessarily, is selective containment. The one ever seeks areas for negotiation and cooperation consistent with civility. The other never shirks competition or even confrontation in defense of liberty. But there is another way of describing the foreign policy I have in mind, for the purpose of which I turn to the statesmanship of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was a master of synthesizing ordinary prudence and lofty principle. Unlike his contemporary moralists, Lincoln was prepared to tolerate the existence of slavery in the South as a necessary evil, but only to avoid a still greater evil, the destruction of the Union. Unlike his contemporary pragmatists, however, Lincoln was unequivocally opposed to the extension of slavery in the territories. For to tolerate slavery in the territories, allowing its white settlers to decide the issue by majority vote, would publicly signify the repeal of the Declaration of Independence and the principle that all men are created equal. Lincoln knew, and the South knew, that if slavery were kept out of the territories, these would eventually be admitted to the Union as free states. Sooner or later, free states would outnumber slave states, in consequence of which the Constitution could be amended, abolishing slavery throughout the Union. By equal reason, if the territories, as a result of the Dred Scott decision, were to become slave states, there would be no publicly affirmed moral principle in terms of which slavery could be prevented from encroaching upon the free states. Lincoln thus agreed with moralists in publicly declaring slavery an evil. But he agreed with pragmatists that the abolition of slavery in the slave states, as proposed by moralists, would destroy the Union. What moralists did not see was that the destruction of the Union would not necessarily lead to the abolition of slavery. What pragmatists did not see was that the toleration of slavery in the territories would not necessarily preserve the Union. Both moralists and pragmatists lacked long-range comprehensive vision, that which comes with philosophic reason. Lincoln understood that in the long run, a republic which does not publicly deplore slavery and oppose its extension will not preserve its freedom. In his own words, either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the due course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all states, old as well as new. Clearly, in opposition to the spirit of Helsinki, Lincoln would never have given his signature to a document which could be construed by the public to have rendered lawful communist domination of Eastern Europe. By no means, however, would he have supported a policy of liberation. He called not for the immediate, but for the ultimate extinction of slavery, and then only in our own country. We deal with it, he said in his sixth debate with Douglas, as with any other wrong, insofar as we can prevent its growing any larger. We have a due regard to the difficulties of getting rid of it in any satisfactory way. We have no right at all to disturb it in the states where it exists. We insist on the policy that shall restrict it to its present limits. Lincoln publicly emphasized that slavery is a wrong precisely because in the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, as well as in the Dred Scott decision, the American government had conveyed a public teaching that slavery is not a wrong. Here, in his own words about the fundamental conflict between himself and Douglas. I suggest that the difference, reduced to its lowest terms, is no other than the difference between the men who think slavery are wrong and those who do not think it are wrong. The Republican Party think it wrong. We think it is a moral, a social, and a political wrong. Because we think it wrong, we propose a course of policy that shall so deal with it that in the run of time, there may be some promise of an end to it. The key issue of the Lincoln-Douglas debates thus turned on the question of what teaching was to shape public opinion, the teaching of Lincoln that slavery was a wrong, or the teaching of Douglas that looked upon slavery with indifference, not caring whether it was voted up or voted down. If mere majorities, however, can determine the question of freedom or servitude, there is an end to Republican government, and we are back to the fundamental principle of the American Revolution, that principle that all men are created equal in their unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Lincoln was willing to bring this country to war rather than sacrifice that first principle of Republican government. Still, his statesmanship of prudence, which transcended moralism and pragmatism, remains a model for those who seek to preserve Republican government in the nuclear age. Let us apply his statesmanship to the overriding issue of this age, the conflict between communism and liberal democracy. As a form of servitude, and let us not forget those slave labor camps, in comparison to which Southern slavery was a beneficent institution. As a form of servitude, communism in areas contiguous with the Soviet Union must be tolerated as a necessary evil in order to avoid a still greater evil, the destruction of mankind. A policy of liberation could lead to Holocaust. Nevertheless, the United States must be unambiguously opposed to the expansion of communism in the territories of the Third World. The nations of the world, of that world, only recently released from colonial status, have yet to develop the cultural qualities and, in those cases, the material resources essential for Republican government. For this reason, they are susceptible to dictatorship and to communist imperialism. If they are to avoid or overcome servitude and be admitted, as it were, into the Union of Free States, they will require the support of the free world, its political and administrative skills, its food technology and surpluses, and above all, conviction. Conviction in the moral superiority of republicanism over communism. This will require from the West infinitely more than professions of faith. Ultimately, the peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America will judge us by the sacrifices we are willing to make on behalf of our faith. Still, a prudent policy of selective containment calls for distinctions, say, on a scale of 1 to 5 between strategic and non-strategic areas. The allocation of resources, not simply for defending, but for liberalizing any particular area, will depend on its strategic significance. And so another description of American foreign policy should be selective liberalism. This is part of a sober policy of magnanimity intended not only to spread the blessings of republicanism and of liberty to the peoples of the Third World, but to preserve those blessings in the free world as well. Failure to oppose the spread of communism in the Third World cannot but lead to the contempt, humiliation, and ultimately the strangulation of the West. Aside from terrorist acts against Western embassies and officials, consider the composition and the conduct of the United Nations, increasingly dominated by communist-supported regimes hostile to Republican government. There, the Afro-Asian bloc, some of whose members still traffic in chattel slavery, are making it ever more difficult for the remaining handful of republics to preserve their economic and political independence. In other words, as the number of people living in servitude increases, the scope of liberty and civility which the West formerly enjoyed decreases. Like any organism, A republic requires a favorable environment. It cannot long survive in an environment of communist or communist-manipulated states. With equal reason, however, a communist regime cannot long survive in an environment of republics animated not by the spirit of Helsinki, but by the spirit of 76. As its very location signifies, the spirit of Helsinki is existentially neutral toward communism. Its teaching to the world at large, certainly to the people of Eastern Europe, is not very different from the teaching of those antebellum pragmatists who did not care whether slavery was voted up or down. Consequently, that teaching will incline more and more men to tolerate the extension of communism in the territories of the Third World and elsewhere as well. To be sure, the teaching, the spirit of Helsinki, is one of peace, but peace primarily understood as the avoidance of conflict. That teaching, to repeat Professor Kedisinger's warning, can only encourage aggression by the most ruthless member of the international community system. It can only eventuate in self-abasement and civility. The spirit of Helsinki, the spirit of 76 rather, yields a different teaching, namely, that genuine peace can only exist amongst just men and just regimes. Accordingly, the peace envisioned by the Declaration of Independence is that positive feeling of mutual trust and confidence among men who enjoy republican liberty and equality and civility. This kind of peace goes far beyond détente and ought to be the proclaimed goal of American foreign policy. Such a peace cannot be achieved without wholehearted dedication, the kind evoked by those statesmen of 76 who, in the peroration of the Declaration, pledged to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. But wholehearted dedication can hardly be achieved, or can't be forthcoming, had not that revolutionary generation believed in the intrinsic justice of their cause. Hence, in the power of reason to apprehend moral and political truths of universal significance, those embodied in the preamble of the Declaration. It was not a pragmatic, but a philosophic reason that enabled the statesmen of the Declaration to articulate those truths or laws of nature, of nature's God, from which they deduced the principles of republican government. For upon reflection, the laws of nature and of nature's God point to the very qualities, I just need 2 minutes, which distinguish the human from the subhuman. I mean not only the power of reason, but that civilizing power of self-restraint, which alone justifies the right of liberty, to right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on the one hand, and government by the consent of the governed on the other. Here then were universal standards by which to judge whether the acts of any government dignified or debased human nature, or whether one form of government was just or unjust. And it was these standards that enabled the statesmen of the Declaration to inspire the American people to unite reason to their passion for justice and their passion for justice to their sense of honor. They did not commit the error of pragmatists who underestimate the importance of publicly articulated principles of morality, nor did they commit the error of moralists who underestimate the necessity of force in defense of morality. I contend that recent American statesmen have largely abandoned the teachings of the Declaration or have failed to grasp the subtle interplay of reason, force, and morality exemplified in the statesmanship of the founding fathers. Perhaps they lack the founders' confidence in the power of human intellect to comprehend truths of universal significance. Or lacking the founders' oratorical skills, perhaps they believe that the elucidation of foreign policy in the light of those truths would arouse violent passions. Whatever the case, it should be emphasized that the principles of the Declaration constitute a genial orthodoxy as much opposed to dogmatism and doctrinarism as to moral indifference and skepticism. That genial orthodoxy, adjusted to the nuclear age, can restore the confidence of the American people and facilitate the development of an American foreign policy which unites principle and prudence, and which therefore can foster republicanism in the world while avoiding armed conflict with the Soviet Union. Ladies and gentlemen, I have taken a little bit more time than I intended. I will have a few more remarks I would like to make in the question period. Thank you.